five subjects. The occasion of sociologist Anne Buff's visit today is the publication of her new book, Biting Off the Bracelet, A Study of Children in Hospitals. This study is based on her extensive research at two Eastern urban hospitals, where she evaluated how responsive the hospital was institutionally to the special needs of children and how children coped with their new identity of patient. She found that modern hospitals have many of the characteristics of the, quote, total institution described by Irving Goffman, such as depersonalization and enforced helplessness, characteristics that contrast sharply with the hospital's goals of caring and healing. Anne Buff also writes that hospitalization magnifies a feeling of powerlessness in children and trains them to be helpless. Anne Buff is on the faculty of the Sociology Department at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the director of the Women's Studies Program at the university. Her new book, Biting Off the Bracelet, is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Anne Buff, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to have you on the
That's
show.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Part of the reason, I think, that you've written this book is your interest in children and children's rights and I think what you might describe as children's liberation.
Yeah, I think that would be valid. I was just reading an article last night that referred to children as the last colonized group in American society, in the sense that other people have control over almost all the basic decisions that are made about children. Even though the child may be the most affected person, there's little input. And just as a capitalist society seeks new markets amongst blacks, or third world peoples to maintain the economy. So there's a tremendous reliance on the tremendous amount of money that children have to spend. So that part of their colonization is their image as a consumer group.
So that's part, I guess, of what you're interested in as far as children's liberation, but I know it goes beyond that as well. Can you give us a sense of what types of children's rights or?
Well, I think one way of approaching is to look at it historically. That our definition of the child as a relatively powerless, rather slowly developing, not terribly competent human being is a recent historical construct. And that in Western society prior to the Industrial Revolution and in other societies which remain agricultural, we find that childhood is a rather short period in the life cycle, lasting from the time someone stops being an infant until around the age of six, when children are betrothed or brought into the economic system as active producers or go through some kind of religious experience which makes them an adult member of the community. And this was typical of our own society in the past. A very popular book this year dealt with something called the Children's Crusade. And this was a point in history during the Middle Ages where a shepherd boy had a vision that he should lead other children to the Middle East to fight the Crusades. And as I read it, I thought about my own nervousness in letting my children cross Lancaster Pike by themselves at the age they were, six. And here are mothers saying, oh, you want to go to the Crusades? Well, here's your lunch and here's your little sheepskin. Goodbye. I'll see you in a few years. Which impresses you with how much more competent and independent they were able to see their children.
It could also be, though, a reflection of the way mothers see their children, the way parents relate to their children. There was no birth control or planning. Children were not planned for as they are now. There were a lot more of them in most families. Of course, a lot more of them died. So there wasn't maybe the same kind of attachment and the same kind of nurturing.
I would agree with that, but I'd still adhere to the other statement, and that is that if we look at what children actually did then, we can see that they were playing very important economic roles. I think the major change in our definition of childhood brought about by the Industrial Revolution is the shift from seeing the child as a potential and an actual producer to seeing the child as a consumer, okay? At the same time, you're quite correct about affect, but it was a less affect-laden era in general. Marriage selection wasn't made on the basis of romantic love. It was made on the basis of practicality. Two families wanted to merge their land. They would arrange a match between their children. A man wanted political allies. He would marry a woman who had many brothers. Or a girl looked like a good, strong woman who could butcher the pigs, and that was a good reason for choosing her as your mate. But the new Western family is seen primarily in emotional rather than practical terms. In fact, as work becomes more technological and more alienating and more emptied of the creative aspects of life, our media encourage us to seek those kinds of satisfaction within the family that we used to find in the work that we did. So I'd say that there's more burden on less people, and that this in a way creates very inflated expectations both for our spouses and for our children.
You're not suggesting that parents should be willing to send their children out on children's crusades, but I think what you are saying is that we assume that children are capable of a lot less than they really are.
Yes. We put on, sometime in the middle of the 19th century, put on a pair of glasses that was called developmental theory. And since then, every time we even look at childhood, we look at it with the assumption that these little bitty steps of competence are inherent in the child. And I think what we learn as sociologists is that they, too, are the construction of certain historical eras. Freud didn't spring out of nothingness, but out of a Jewish, Western, European, rapidly industrializing, middle-class culture, and his theories reflect it.
You say that children are frequently seen as the possessions
Yes.
of their parents. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the child, having lost his or her economic definition, has two meanings. I mean, people will ask me when I say that, then why do people go on having children? It made sense for the farmer to have 12 children because more hands for the work. But why do middle-class professionals continue to have children? Well, one answer to that is, well, they're having a lot fewer than they used to. The birth rate in the United States has declined from something like 8 in 1850 per woman to less than 1. Okay, so they are having fewer, but they're still having them. And the question is, what needs does the child then fill? And I think part of it relates back to what we were previously discussing, and that is the notion that especially if the parents have been frustrated in the fulfillment of any of their dreams and ambitions, the child becomes the source through which the parent thinks these ambitions will eventually be realized. The parent whose parents couldn't afford college, who's going to produce a brain surgeon. Okay. The other is that children become display cases for their parents' upward mobility. One has only to talk to mothers of kindergartners to hear about the competition to have superior birthday parties. And as a mother, I can recall that the person who had a live magician was definitely more highly regarded than someone who sent everyone out on a scavenger hunt. And then, you know, that was ultimately topped by someone who took 30 children to a very famous amusement park around here. So that they become the showcase by which the parent can display acquired wealth. So a child has two functions then. His future definition, what he will be, which is the realization of the parent's dreams, and his present definition, which is usually in terms of what we're able to give him.
If I said that the children are the responsibility of their parents as opposed to the children are the possessions of their parents, would that be very different?
Yes. Possessions are the products of objectification. Okay? Responsibility implies a human relationship. Involves defining the other party as another human being for whom one has responsibility and about whom one cares. Possessions are material objects, by and large, and there's a certain objectification to the child in the process of seeing the child as a possession. I'm thinking of a local magazine, for instance, which last, I think it was November or December, the cover article was, "How much does it cost to raise a child?" And the article told you, down to the cent, how much it would cost to raise a child from birth till it was through college. And it was all added up on calculators. And I would suggest that a society that saw its children as responsibilities would almost have been incapable of generating such an article. It's only a society that sees children as expensive that can even produce a culture that talks about that.
Let me apply this to an experience that both parents and non-parents have probably lived through a lot of times. You're in, say, a restaurant, place that should be moderately quiet and under control, and there's one child who is running, screaming back and forth around the tables, tripping over things, getting in the waiter's and waitress's way, and perhaps becoming a disturbance for the people who are trying to eat their dinner. Is it the parent's responsibility at that point, applying this model, to control their kids? Does that make, if they do take responsibility for that, is that responsibility or is that treating the child as a possession? Can we apply what you're saying to that type of situation at all?
Oh, yes. If you have responsibility for the child, one of your responsibilities is that the child's actions don't harm other people. In fact, the last White House conference on youth in 1960 boiled down a lot of the notions about children to very few rights. And one of them was the child has the right to do his own thing or her own thing unless that impinges on the rights of others. And a responsible parent realizes that. A lazy one doesn't. Yankelovich did a very big survey on the family a couple of years ago, and he ended up talking about two types of family, the old breed, as he calls them, and the new breed. And one of the characteristics of the new breed is a certain laissez-faire attitude about discipline and responsibility. And the researchers immediately say, following the table where they show this data, this is not the permissiveness of the 50s, which was done for the child's own good and developmental purposes. This is a responsibility on the part of parents who don't want to be bothered. Okay, so that there are two different kinds of permissiveness. And I mean, if that were my child, I'd say, look, you sit down and you eat with everyone else and you act like the other people here, or you'll have to spend the rest of the evening in the car.
So when you say children's liberation, you don't mean, oh, let them be free and do what they please, when they please, wherever they please.
I think I mean that you couldn't change one thing, like whether they're going to run around in restaurants. It would only be in a society where from the beginning that child had been treated as a human being deserving of notice for appropriate behavior. Then, first of all, it wouldn't occur in such a society. I have worked with American Indians, as you know, and when adults are talking in American Indian society, children do not run around and scream. And one of the reasons is that when it's the child's turn to speak, everyone will listen just as hard as they did when grandfather spoke. So the child doesn't need to clamor for his time and his space. It's a given that as another member of the human race, he or she is deserving of a lot of respect.
What are some instances in American society where you think that children should have a stronger voice in situations that are going to affect their own lives?
Well, two things that occur to me immediately are custody cases and school situations. I think that it's very weird, given the nature of our Constitution, that it is a custody decision which concerns the child more than any other party does not automatically call for someone to represent the rights of the child and to pay attention to the child's wishes.
There's frequently been psychologists, right, who step in, talk a lot with the child, and try to represent the child in court in some way.
Well, what usually happens, though, is that the divorce system is set up in such an adversary way that custody is gained by showing that you are the better parent. And this automatically sets up an adversary system between the parents in which the child is not represented except via one of the parents. So that the psychologist employed by the mother has as a kind of secondary latent function to show that the mother is a better parent than the father.
Aren't
and
there
vice versa.
Court-appointed child advocates?
There was a very important book published several years ago called Beyond the Best Interests of the Child by Freud and Goldstein and Solnit. And in the New England area, there has been experimentation with appointing an attorney as a third attorney for the child. The problem is still one that they pointed out in their book, which is it's going to have to be a third profession, a new kind of professional who combines a knowledge of child psychology with training in the law. What seems to be happening is that these lawyers come in and represent the children, but in very, very legalistic terms of precedent and citation of former cases, rather than saying, look, this is a six-year-old boy who has a lot of concern about his masculinity. It'd be a good idea for him to live with his father. And that's what's still missing, although we seem to be moving a little bit in that direction. The other positive thing is that many judges will take a child over 12 or 14 into chambers and simply ask the child what the child's preference is and will be directed by that to some extent.
What are some other instances where you'd like to see children have a stronger, more considered voice in their affairs?
Well, I would say in the book, I indicate that children are tremendously objectified by medical procedures, and that many of the rights that adult patients are now learning as health consumers are really not part of the deal in children's hospitals at all. They aren't informed sometimes about what the process will be by which a test will be run. They may not even be told why it's being run. They may be told some of that information, but in such jargon that they can't understand what the meaning of it really is. Their parents' permission rather than theirs is what's necessary to do some kinds of procedures. And I find that difficult. I mean, I think that by the time someone's six, if you give them a good explanation of why an X-ray is being done, they can make that choice. And in fact,
can you explain to them what it is or how it operates or what the hazards of being exposed to a radioactive invisible ray would be? Things get so abstract when you're dealing with modern surgical operations and apparatus.
I agree with you, but I don't see that that justifies using age as the criteria for making those decisions. It's confusing to me, and I'm very middle-aged, okay? Those decisions are difficult. And I don't think it's almost an illusion we create that it gets simpler as you get older. It doesn't. It gets more complicated, perhaps. I think the child should be informed of what the positive diagnostic abilities of an X-ray machine are, why they're choosing to use that rather than some other device, but should also be told of some of the dangers of radiation. And here again, you need someone who's going to terrify the child. The ill effects of radiation have tended to be exaggerated. I mean, one chest X-ray is probably going to do a lot of good for a child who has pneumonia compared to the harm it will do. We simply don't want to overexpose children over and over again. And I think most children, if they've been treated as adults in the past, can deal with that. And that's why I keep coming back to the idea that it's a social problem. As long as we continue to treat children in a way that verifies our concept of them as wild, incompetent, crazy little people, they're going to behave that way. That's what sociologists call self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, what's the way around this, do you think? What kind of responsibilities would you want a child to share, and say, at the age of 3 or 4, before they're even in kindergarten? Because that's a time when my notion of childhood is that it's a period when the child is usually living in a fairly unstructured environment at home, which isn't to say a home in which the parents don't care or aren't taking care of the child, but it's not like there's a schedule that the child has to routinely adhere to. There's few, if any, responsibilities that the child really has. Who knows what a child of 3 is really capable of contributing to the running of a home. What would you like to see happen that you think would help a child develop as more capable, aware, small human being?
I think we have to just start taking them seriously, first of all. I mean, I think that it's as basic as acquiring a self-concept that has some meaning. Every major social or psychological theorist has written about this. Erikson calls it trust versus mistrust, and Piaget calls it his third stage, and there are a variety of names for it. George Herbert Mead's called it the development of a knower within the known. How is it that we as a species can look at ourselves we can back off from ourselves and look at ourselves and scrutinize ourselves. And that's really what personality involves. And that if we don't treat people seriously from the very beginning, the danger is they don't acquire a sense of themselves as an effective, role-playing, active member of the society. I mean, the basic thing that all development theorists I know talk about is during the very early stages, what happens when the infant cries? Does somebody show up to do something about it? It doesn't matter so much what they do, whether you feed them or rock them or warm them up or change their diapers. It's the developing notion in that infant that I make this noise and someone responds to it that is the basis of the notion of human competence. Because the infant then learns there's a predictability to it. Whenever I cry, I can make this other person come. That must mean I'm a pretty powerful person. You know, I have this ability to cause things to happen in my environment. It's not simply a case of the environment washing over me and determining everything that happens to me.
But the flip side of that becomes that if the child learns, well, I cry and I affect all these changes around me, people drop what they're doing and they come, a child can use it to get attention just for the sake of attention. Not that there's anything wrong with the child getting attention, but that crying becomes a tool which he can manipulate or she can manipulate to get attention. And how then, as a parent, you have to figure out a way out of that, a way out of having taught the child in a way that crying can be used as a way to manipulate the parents.
Oh, right, but you're kind of jettisoning
right.
the developmental stage while you're saying that. Children don't keep on using crying as their primary communications method for very long. I mean, pretty soon that will switch to positive sounds like gurgling, and before long to words and gestures. And then parents can begin paying heed to those things that represent responsible, appropriate behavior on the part of the child and ignoring the others, which is a very good way of not having them develop. I mean, when a child knows how to talk and ask for something and sits at the table and sees the milk at the other side and goes, you just don't give him the milk until he does what you know he's capable of doing, which is saying, I want some milk. Then you deliver. So I think that there's a real important line to be drawn between predictability, which is what I'm stressing, predictability of response, and then later using that as a manipulative tool. Parents have to be real careful about that. But my feeling is that there's another relationship, and that is that the child who is taken seriously has very little need for manipulative tools.
I'd like to ask you, if I could, to talk to us as a mother for a couple of minutes. And I'll say, as I would in a circumstance like this, that I don't want to get, you know, any more personal than you want to get. So if you don't want to answer it, that's okay with me. As a parent, I'd wonder how, if you gave your son, when he was real young, like more responsibility than you see other parents around you giving. If the things that you're saying to us now as a sociologist really affected the environment in which your son grew up and the way you responded.
I think a lot of it depends on which child it is. I have three.
Oh, I've only got one.
And I've probably dealt with all of them somewhat differently. And I have to confess that in my early days as a mother, I think I was very overprotective. But then my research, I mean, it's interesting how you go back and forth between the research and your own life. What most people assume is that your own life influences your research. But the reverse is true. And by the time I got to number three, and I had gotten respect for the competence of little children, I was much more careful about that. I've given him much more latitude of choice, I think, than I did the older ones. And I, in that sense, I think I've grown as a parent from doing this kind of research.
Have you found that your third child seemed competent in, like, not crawling on high precipices and drinking damaging potions and turpentine and things
yes,
like this.
Yes, he's very level-headed. He's very adult in his, I guess what we would call adult in his approach to life and responsibility and that kind of thing. For instance, he's totally self-motivated about his schoolwork. We don't have to ever say, now it's time for you to sit down and work. He already knows how to ration time between amusement and work and just being at ease. And I think that's partly a product of this attitude. But the other thing that I have to really hasten to add is I think it would be difficult for anybody in this society to pull it off, okay? Because no matter what you're doing for your child, the whole media thing, the whole culture, all the peers in school are products of this Western cultural definition of the child. And there's the terrible pitfall for that is, unless you're very careful, your child may interpret the independence you're trying to give him as neglect in the face of all these other overprotective children. Yeah.
This is other image that we have of the child square, the child who's so responsible, who carries a briefcase or a little attaché case with him wherever he goes, and who wears glasses. This is just the stereotype.
Right.
I have nothing against glasses. I'm just painting the stereotype. And they're so responsible, and they get great grades. This is really scorned by a lot of people. It's not considered a sign of advanced responsibility, except perhaps by the child's teachers. At least it was this way when I was growing up, that this type of child was really disliked by their peers.
Yes.
And then parents would say, oh, it's such a shame. Poor Johnny is not being able to enjoy the experience of being a real child.
At the same time, they're putting incredible pressure on their child to pull grades like Johnny does. I mean, again, we see this incredible ambivalence on the part of American parents. They'll talk about that as a negative image, but boy, they wish their kid had Johnny's grades. I mean, we see more children in analysis now than in any other historical period. And it's not about sexual matters and identity crises. It's about their anxiety. They have free-floating anxiety like business executives and people in the tenure system and universities. And it's this incredible investment I referred to before of parental hopes and dreams. You're going to fail your parent somehow. Children who get migraine headaches in the fifth grade before tests and that kind of thing. And that is a negative stereotype, but on the other hand, we worship it. Everyone would like to have a Johnny, you know, because then you can send him to Harvard and that'll be a big deal. On the other hand, I think that if that same child also knows how to take pleasure in the company of other people, enjoys a sports program, has some creative interests, then we're doing him a disservice by stereotyping him that way. There's really nothing negative about knowing how to take care of yourself and to plan your time.
And Buff, before we get more specifically to your study of the way hospitals treat children who are being treated there, I'd like to ask you about the way that many parents try to protect their children from the tragedies of life, from death, from deprivation, from pain, from seeing terrible things, from exposure to terrible things. I think it's out of deep love that most parents who do try to protect their children from these things do it. What would your reaction be to, like, trying to keep death or keep the understanding of death from a child? We all remember the first time we asked what death was and the, you know, silly story we got
like
in response to it.
Or
being kept out of funerals, you know. Not that that was a terrible thing, being kept out of it, but really being protected from the funeral process, being protected from, to an extent, the mourning.
Yes.
That family went through?
I think that's a real important point. And one thing that I keep coming up against over and over again is the parallels between what sexuality was 20 years ago and what death is now. That the idea of having death education in schools sends people up the walls the way sex education did. That parents have that same nervous response when the child asks a question. It's like this is the big taboo of our era. We've kind of gotten along a little bit with sexuality, but we got this new thing. And I think it's a fraud to try to protect children against these things. I agree with you that it's well-motivated, but it lacks a very important component of what children are, which is independent thinking human beings who put things together for themselves. It's a very rare child who's completely deluded that his grandmother has died. No matter how many times you tell him she just wants to stay in Canada, he knows. I mean, he's overheard references or conversations, or he notices that she doesn't send letters anymore. And almost every time the psychologists say that child is eventually in treatment, it doesn't take long for the child to say, oh, I knew she was dead all the time. The problems now are that we are overdoing the other side. And that is, instead of dealing with the child's feelings about death, the death education movement, and there is such a thing in this country, is emphasizing cognitive knowledge. That if a child can understand the scientific process of death, this will help the child overcome fears and anxieties and the pain associated with the death of a friend or a relative. And I've attended some conferences on this, and they leave me absolutely appalled. For instance, books that describe how organs don't function after grandfather is dead. Or some psychologists who keep something called decomposition chambers in their offices, where a child can watch a cat decompose and be instructed in the chemical process as a form of therapy. And I think this is absolutely outlandish because it trivializes the child's relationship with this departed person into a mere exercise in science instruction. And children really don't care what kinds of chemicals are formed by decomposition. Children want to know, where is he? Will I ever see him again? Did he feel really bad when he died? Really important things to them that should be dealt with head on and up front. And the emphasis on the scientific, I think, is simply another form of denial.
Well, I think people are so afraid now to confront things like that, because with the knowledge that we have about psychiatry and psychology, and the knowledge that none of it is perfect anyways, that none of what we know really is perfect or is all that helpful sometimes either, we know that we know enough to know that we can cause damage, but we also know that we don't know enough to prevent ever causing damage, and it leaves you in a real bind sometimes where you know all the damage you can create. You think something might leave terrible marks on a child. So it must be really hard for parents to decide what to do, how far to go with a child, what to tell them, what not to. And there's plenty of guidebooks you can hear people talk, but I guess it's ultimately everyone's got to decide for yourself.
I think you do, but the other thing I think, and that I mention in the book, is Arlene Skolnick's work on helplessness and powerlessness. And there's one interesting point at which she says, you know, after all this kind of philosophizing and theorizing we've done, maybe the feeling of control or powerlessness or the competence I just talked about is the most important thing. I'm paraphrasing her now, but she says, it may not be so important to a child whether his action causes a positive or negative thing to happen, as his having been able to cause something to happen. And that it may not be the bad or the good that ultimately plays the important role in child development, but the issue of whether the child could make it happen or was restrained from making it happen. At least of seeing my impact on that environment. And so I think we have to keep that in mind all the time, that maybe we've been looking at the wrong thing, that maybe whether it hurts the child or doesn't hurt the child isn't the only issue. Maybe the issue is, how competent does the child feel now to handle this? Even if handling it takes the form of rage or an outburst of hysteria, at least giving the child that choice by giving honest information and by openly dealing with the feelings that are associated with whatever the thing is they happen to be looking at.
And before we get to the subject of your recent study, let me reintroduce you for those of our listeners who are just joining us. My guest is sociologist Ann Buff. She's on the faculty of the Sociology Department at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's also the director of the Women's Studies Program. We're going to be talking now about the subject of her new book, which is very related to what we've been discussing. It's the treatment of children in hospitals and how much power or powerlessness is encouraged within their stay in the hospital. She's written a book based on her extensive research in two Eastern urban hospitals. Her book is called Biting Off the Bracelet, A Study of Children in Hospitals, and it's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Why did you look to hospitals? Why did you choose that type of institution where children are to look at reactions, interactions between institutions and children?
Well, I always had somewhat of an interest in the sociology of medicine. And I guess one could call it a critical interest. I was unhappy with the existing body of knowledge in that a lot of the sociology of medicine in the past has dealt with the role of the physician or other medical professional rather than focusing on the patient. And I really felt that I was interested in doing something on the patient. As a mother, I had seen all three of my children in hospitalized situations at one time or another. And this seemed like a really important area to look at. When I looked at the figures, you know, I find that there are enormous numbers of children who are hospitalized every year, not particularly for serious things or terminal illness, but who break a leg or have their tonsils out or, you know, enough to make them stay overnight in a hospital. And the other thing that had struck me as a sociologist when my children were in the hospital was this kind of two levels of goal. On the one hand, the articulated goal of the hospital to be kind, benevolent, caring, nurturant, and curing of children's illnesses. But on the other, the existence of the hospital is a bureaucracy. And we know sociologically bureaucracies have their own wheels that spin, that kind of drive onward no matter what the articulated goal is. And these have to do with time, always getting things done on time, with being efficient, with staying in the black, with making sure that everyone receives the uniform treatment, that people are shuffled about in groups for the sake of efficiency, that the meals are all the same because it's cheaper than offering people a lot of choices, that it's really easier to put all children in hospital pajamas because you know they've been washed in lots of Clorox and sterilized, and a number of other things of this sort, which routinize the hospital and operate ultimately against its other interests of curing and caring.
Most of the things that you described, I think, are experiences that any adult would have in hospital, too, not really having much of a choice of food, having to do things at a certain preordained scheduled time. Are there specific instances in which children are treated in ways different from adults that you think would really encourage a sense of helplessness or dehumanization?
I think that the only main difference, basically, is that the children are children and that they're developing the personality and the ego strength that will see them through the rest of their lives, that they are more vulnerable because they haven't yet learned the defenses to employ that adults do. I mean, adults have all kinds of strategies they develop in the hospital to protect their psyche from what's really going on. Children are somewhat naive still about that, and they're more vulnerable as a result. But toward the end of the book, I point out that one of the ironies is that all of this stuff could be applied to the adult patient in one way or another. But let me just point out a couple of things that got me thinking. Traditional sociology has always defined the sick role in a number of specific ways. One of the characteristics has been the notion that the sick role is such an encompassing role that a person is never blamed for being sick. I mean, that our culture just feels sorry for people who are ill. You know, that's the role as it's defined. But I kept finding that children, in fact, were not exempt from blame for their sick roles, that a child who had been injured in an accident would be reprimanded for the behavior that had led to the accident. How many times did I tell you not to cross the street until the light was green? That children who were having peaks in their chronic diseases, such as a diabetic who was going through a bad period, would be suspected by their parents of having broken their diet or indulged in some form of forbidden activity. And this blame was very obvious. And that is more open in the children's hospital because adults can talk to children like that. Yet, the more you think about it, the more you realize that this is a general trend in the culture, that with our emphasis on health foods, exercise, and so on, we at some level often blame the adult patient for their sick status, too. A person had a heart attack, it's because he didn't stay in shape. Somebody got diabetes, it's because they've been living on starches all along instead of eating things from the health food store. Or even things like heart attacks now. People are saying, well, he was always so compulsive. You know, if he would just have relaxed a little bit, it wouldn't have happened to him. So it's interesting. Looking at the children's world can give you kind of a view into other adult problems that are shared by all patients. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that children are not given vacations from their other roles the way adults are. The adult patient is usually seen as being in the hospital and doing what the hospital requires, but certainly not expected to go to work or take on other outside roles. And within the children's hospital, we see an emphasis on continuing outside role patterns, such as having the teacher come into the school, so the child's maintaining student status as well as patient status. And you also, ironically, often find parents demanding that the child play the filial role more intensely in the hospital than under normal circumstances. And I think this comes from the parents' anxiety. They want to see the child look happy. They always want the child to look pleased when they come in. They want the child to be grateful for everything that's done for him in the hospital. And my interpretation of that anyhow was that this is a way of handling the guilt parents feel about putting children in the hospital in the first place. But it's certainly not a vacation from the filial role. You have to play it harder than ever.
So these things, you think, create a lot of stresses in the child who's in a hospital?
Those are minor, I think, compared to the imposition of the total institution factors on the child. And Goffman, in his book Asylums, noted several characteristics of total institutions. First of all, that they're rather bureaucratic in nature. They tend to move people about in groups, and that this ultimately has the effect of depersonalization. If your pajamas are just like everybody else's pajamas, if your room looks just like everybody else's room, if you're referred to by your room number like the kid in 583 instead of your name, that's an objectification process. Goffman also talks about things that he calls forced interaction. And this is when you don't have control over your social environment, that other people can come in and out of your personal space without asking your permission or caring how you feel about it. They can handle your belongings, and in this case, even your body, without your wanting it or, in fact, against your protests. He also speaks of the presence of what he calls mortification rituals in total institutions. And I suppose if there's a shocking aspect to the book, this is what's shocking, because, of course, Goffman created his image out of work in asylums of different sorts, prisons, and with reference to work that some people had done on concentration camps. Okay, so to draw this parallel between those kind of institutions and the children's hospital may seem outlandish or shocking, but basically I could see rituals within the children's hospitals that served the purpose Goffman assigns them, which is to teach the inmate from the very first minute that this is an institution which is based on obedience to authority, and that if you buck that authority, you will be humiliated until you learn to do what they want you to. And I saw this over and over again.
Give us an example, could you?
I'll give you two examples. One is teaching rounds, okay? In a university or medical school-affiliated hospital, maybe not all the audience knows what a teaching round is, so let me just define it. About once or twice a day, a physician who's considered an authority in a field will come around from bed to bed in his area of medical specialty, bringing with him a train of learners. other doctors, younger doctors, residents, interns, medical students, maybe 6 to 10 people, and will stand at the bed of the patient, give the history to this group, and use it as a teaching situation. Now, what happens here is the total objectification of the child. The child is simply grist for their intellectual mill, okay? His pain is data to them, and they're going to analyze it. And the child's feelings are completely neglected while the professor holds forth, or while two residents get in a fight about what he really has, because they're both trying to show the professor who's smarter, or while Latin names are applied to the illness, which the child hasn't ever heard before, and that has weird effects. For instance, some children have been told they have sugar when they have diabetes, and then they hear these guys talking about diabetes mellitus, and they think they've got a new one, too. You know, I've got sugar and I've got diabetes mellitus. Okay. And the child is literally treated like a thing. And there's nothing the child can do in this situation. The child is utterly powerless to de-objectify himself under those situations. So I think that's a biggie, okay? Another situation is admissions, where, in fact, the child's characteristics that are examined are those which simply make him a member of the human species, okay? Temperature, height, weight. Questions that are asked about the child's medical condition are almost invariably asked to another person, and the child is spoken about in the third person, although the child might be quite capable of answering the question. Common question, for instance, is he eating all right? I mean, most people from 4 years on can tell you whether they're eating and whether they are enjoying their meals. You know, you don't have to ask a third person that. The other real sensitive area, especially for children who have come from rather traditional backgrounds, is that the hospital environment involves a lot of what Goffman called stripping, which is, you know, he uses it very symbolically. I found it was very literally done in hospitals, where children be left naked in the hall outside x-ray or something like that. And many of these kids have been taught that that's very bad, or that it's bad to expose your genitals to someone. Okay, and here this place demands that you do it. So that's very confusing as well as very humiliating. Can I give one more example? I have a case that's kind of crystallized it for me and is in the book. And this was while I was doing my research. One day I was waiting for an elevator. And when the elevator came, inside the elevator, there was a little boy about 7 years old, dressed only in a pair of underpants, with major burn scars all over his body. And his arms were splinted straight out to keep the scabs from rubbing on each other. So the child was almost in a crucified position, unable to move in this fashion. And when I, first of all, I tried to get him back to his floor, and then I inquired into what had happened, and it turned out that he had started following one of the residents around that morning. And the guy had no time for him. The guy had time obligations. I mean, he had to finish his rounds by a certain time. He had to give a presentation that afternoon. He felt very pressured, too. And the kid eventually followed him onto the elevator. And the resident was so angry that when he got off at his floor, he turned around to the kid and said, "Go back to your floor." Now, this was utterly impossible for the child because with his arms splinted out at his sides, he couldn't reach any of the buttons. And by his own estimation, he had ridden that elevator for half an hour, waiting for somebody to push the button to his floor so he could get off. This was probably, you know, the most crystallizing example for me, because it showed how the pressure of time causes well-meaning people to behave in a rather cruel fashion. It showed how a child's destiny can be determined by a machine. I mean, he had no personhood. He was going to go to whatever floor that elevator went to until somebody came in and pushed the right button or asked him.
Well, the people who you're referring to, the doctors and the nurses, have their time schedule set for them.
That's
and
right.
And are under a lot of pressure. What are some of the ways you see out of this if a hospital asked you to make recommendations for changing the institution, thereby altering the kind of treatment that children receive, what would you recommend?
I think you'd have to have a total revolution in medical and ethical values. As I say, this was not a horrible person, this resident. He was a nice guy most of the time. But the basis on which medical students are evaluated has very little to do with humane treatment. It has to do with knowing your stuff about electrolytes or having read everything in the latest issue of the New England Journal of Medicine or being able to read the CAT scan properly. And no one cares, to some extent, what you know about the child's worries and fears and anxieties. And until those are given a lot of importance, first in medical school, and second, in the example set by adult physicians, it's going to stay that way. There's nothing we can do. There's no artificial thing you can do to break into that system and change it. The other thing is to make it clear that you're going to, I mean, right now, you might even have to be a little punitive and say that not only will you reward people who show that humanity, but that people who don't show it are going to be punished. I mean, since we live in this competitive dog-eat-dog society where everyone wants to be a doctor right now, one thing you can say is, we're not going to give you honors, you junior medical student, if you don't treat children decently, if you don't treat them as people. That should count just as much as your ability to read an EKG or something like that. That's one way to revolutionize it. Nurses really need the least revolution. They tend to be, possibly because they're women and have been socialized to be sensitive to nonverbal cues and to people's concerns, they tend to be the most empathetic people in hospitals. But their hierarchy imposes discipline again. And again, we need to break into the hierarchy and say, you know, this nurse should not be judged according to whether she got finished taking all the temperatures on time. If she took half an hour late because she was talking to a child to make that child less afraid of a medical procedure that the child will undergo that day, she should be high evaluations, not low ones, for not getting finished on time. So I think breaking into the evaluation processes for the professionals is important. The other thing I think is that every member of the hospital community has to be recognized as important in the child's life. And one thing that I found no getting away from was that the people who perform menial jobs in children's hospitals feel justifiably that they're at the bottom of the heap, that they're dumped on by everybody else in the society. They are low-paying, low-status jobs, and often they will turn around and be extremely insensitive to the child. And I don't think that there's any way you can kind of talk that away. I think the thing one does is define that the role of working in a child's hospital is a very important role that requires developmental psychology, sensitivity to other people's interests, and once you've instructed people in that, you raise their pay because they're specialists. They're not just cleaning ladies. They are cleaning ladies who understand child psychology and are a working part of the hospital and should be paid on a professional scale instead of, you know, this hierarchical arrangement that we have. Because then there are two things that would happen then. One is that their status gets the acknowledgement it deserves, okay? But the other is you can fire them if they're not nice, okay? Now, well, why should you fire someone who's not nice to a patient? They've got a crummy life. Nobody's nice to them. And if they get the floor clean, they're doing their job properly. But if the job gets defined as cleaning floors and interacting with the child, and the person doesn't do either one, then you can justifiably fire them. But right now, I wouldn't see any reason for firing them.
Do you ever feel, and we only have a couple of minutes to discuss this in, that some of the dehumanizing things that happen within an institution, like a hospital, comes down in the long run to things like budget? Because if there was enough money to hire a lot more doctors and a lot more nurses, and if there was a lot more annexes and more beds and more space and more people to clean the hospital, that there'd be less pressure on all of the staff, that there'd be more time to get to know and to understand the child and to treat them as an individual human being with certain likes and dislikes and needs.
I think it would be a big help. I think it would immeasurably help the situation. But I think we can't ignore something else, and that is that we are at this point at a crisis of American values. What I see happening to the physician's role is a splitting of that role into the scientific healer on the one hand and the carer on the other. And the way this is being bifurcated is to take the most aggressive, competitive, compulsive members of the upper middle class and give them scientific training. And those people we call doctors. Then there's another group of people, which can be the elderly, poor minority women, housewives who don't have anything else to do, and we train them on how to be nice and caring to people, and we bring them into the hospital and call them carers or volunteers. And my own anxieties about the situation will not be at ease until we have reinstituted a physician, healer, carer role, which is that the same person who does the healing does the caring.
And Buff, we're almost out of time. Before we have to end the show this afternoon, I want to ask you about a convention that I know is a conference that I know is going to be coming up soon dedicated to, I guess, Margaret Mead.
That's right. Women's Studies is, and with the help of the National Endowment for the Humanities, is holding a day-long conference in memory of Margaret Mead, October 13th at the McNeil Building at Penn, which is at 38th and Locust Walk. And the purpose of the meeting is, besides paying tribute to Margaret Mead, is to give, to display the works of young scholars who are carrying on the various kinds of research that Margaret Mead helped to start or to develop to a very high point of sophistication. There's no charge for the conference. There will be a slight charge for lunch if people want to eat lunch. Some of the things that will happen are that we're going to have workshops on women in all different areas of the world, such as in the South Pacific and in Africa. Also a session with one of the folklorists who has done special work on women as healers in different societies. In the afternoon, we will also have a woman who is looking at archaeological imagery of women at the oldest known archaeological dig at Çatalhöyük in Turkey, and a young professor from the University of Mississippi who has done a very beautiful movie called Four Women Artists, which is first-person accounts by four Southern women about how their art of various forms developed. And in the morning, two women who worked very closely with Margaret Mead will do some biographical descriptions of her.
Is there a phone number that anyone who would like to attend could call to find out times and
yes.
schedules?
Yes, 243-8740. That's the Women's Studies office, and anybody there would be glad to supply you with information or a registration form. But you can also register the day of the conference.
That's great. So that's 243-8740.
Right.
Anne Buff, it's really been a pleasure to have you here. I look forward to the next time you come on Fresh Air. It's always interesting. My guest has been Anne Buff. She is on the faculty of the Sociology Department at Penn. She's also the director of the Women's Studies program there. Her new book, which describes the study that she was talking with us about, the study of how children are treated in hospitals, is called Biting Off the Bracelet, A Study of Children in Hospitals, and it's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, we're going to continue at 4 o'clock talking about health and talking about healthcare delivery systems in America. We'll be joined from New York by David Rossner, who has written a social history of medicine in America. There's great chapters in it, like Medicine in Brooklyn, 1905 to 1912. I think it's going to be real interesting. He'll be with us at 4 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Jane Kindler, who is the editor of Prevention Magazine, and she's written many books on organic foods and on nutrition. At 3:30, Francis Davis and John Zwed team up together for this week's edition of Interval, so I hope you can join us then. Technical direction this afternoon provided by Joyce Lieberman. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Bob Edwards.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
Grandparents were slaves, and they had to work for a dollar a day and 50 cents a day. And that piece of property is valued to me. I don't want any money for it. I just want to keep it in the family.
See, our motto is keep it black or get more jack.
You'll hear another bid, $61,500.
We're hearing the sound of heartbreak, corporate interests bidding for land held by generations of a single family for over 100 years. Tonight on All Things Considered, blacks in the South are paying for the absence of legal niceties during the Reconstruction era.
The Pope's visit continues to dominate this day's news. John Paul praised America's tradition of liberty in New York's Battery Park, spoke to an audience of young people at Madison Square Garden, and then went on to Philadelphia.
More masses and speeches there, including a major address on the American priesthood.
We wonder how he keeps up the pace, so we ask NPR's Cokie Roberts.
Then these stories. The administration wins one on the Energy Mobilization Board.
Consumer groups accuse the oil companies of price gouging on home heating oil.
That and more this evening on All Things Considered. First, the news and Diane Diamond.
It was a rainy day in New York, but more than a million New Yorkers turned out to see Pope John Paul II. He started his morning with a prayer service at St. Patrick's Cathedral. He then addressed a group of 20,000 young people at Madison Square Garden. Most of them were students of Catholic schools. The Pope talked to them about the virtues of a Catholic education as preparation for their serious duties in life. In return, the pontiff was given a traditional teenage gift, a pair of jeans and a T-shirt. It was then off to a ticker tape parade down Broadway and a speech about liberty at Battery Park. With the Statue of Liberty behind him, the pontiff spoke of the symbolic importance of the statue.
This is an impressive symbol of what the United States has stood for from the very beginning of its history. This is a symbol of freedom. It reflects the immigrant history of the United States, for it was freedom that millions of human beings were looking for on this shore.
The Pope's final goodbye to New York came at Shea Stadium, where an estimated 70,000 waited up to 3 hours in the rain for a final glimpse. The crowds were so enormous, the Pope ran behind schedule most of today. This afternoon, he took off for Philadelphia, where tens of thousands of people turned out to greet him. His motorcade took him directly to the Cathedral of St. Peter and Paul, where he repeated his message of love and reconciliation.
Today, by the grace of God, I come here as successor of Peter to bring you a message of love and to strengthen you in your faith.
Pope John Paul.